All right. Welcome back, everybody.
Yay.
Welcome back to me. So, Joey actually mentioned something this morning that I wanted to expand a little bit on for this session, which is going to be part text focused and part performance focused, which is why I wanted to do it down here. It's upstairs. Text only, Beit Midrash. No, it's like one of those things where it's overlaid with gold, but this is a better sound down here. So, Joey mentioned about that leaders and followers are, the follower is at least as important as the leader. And I wanted to just frame this investigation to a couple of sources by exploring what makes the ideal member of the Kahal. I have my own very particular thoughts on this, but I want to hear your thoughts before I offer my prescriptions. What are the characteristics of somebody who's entering the Kahal as a davener? Yeah.
They should say amen when people are saying blessings.
Great. Okay. So one thing is that there are. I'm going to write this down also. There are a lot of call and response moments in the davening, and if you're the shliach tzibor, you know that there's nothing more lonely than doing the prompt and having it crickets, you know, as the response. So there is the amen. Amen can be very, very supportive for.
Responsibly.
Can I get an amen? Exactly.
Testify.
Okay. What else? What else besides amen? A lot of those. Yeah.
Certain amount of buying in.
Say more.
A sense that. We're in a certain project together. It doesn't mean that everybody has to have like a unified vision of what we're trying to accomplish, but a sense that we are indeed trying to accomplish something together.
Okay, good. So there's a mental attitude of, you know, chasidim arishonim ayu shohin shachat lifnei tefillah. You know, people would spend an hour, the pious ones would spend an hour preparing for tefillah. You have to be in some mental state, which is basically, we're here together to do something. And that that is not, cannot be carried alone by the leader.
I would want, if I was the shliach tzibor, I would want people who were confident in their davening and were able to stay with the group, but also able to do their own thing when it was time to do their own thing. So both at the same time.
Just say a little bit more about do their own thing.
Like, you know, to be able to find meaning in their own personal prayers at the same time as finding meaning in the prayers of the community.
Uh-huh. Okay, great. So people who are, how did you point it? Experienced or self-actualized daveners that will
confident.
Allow the confident daveners that will allow you not to be the only person who's creating meaning or opportunities for meaning in the room. There's some thought that we're distributed responsibility around that. Yeah.
I think it makes it easier as a shliach tzibor if the people in the room are following you, if they're actually watching you a little bit and listening to you, like as opposed to maybe drowning you out or as opposed to doing their own thing, but actually
paying attention to you.
Yeah, I mean, some people follow and some people don't.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. We're going to look at some sources around that.
You have to listen to them too. I mean,
right.
There's a tight back and forth
that's going on there, and we're going to look at some sources around the prayers that are specifically designed for more unity around that stuff. So we'll look into that. But there's certainly this dialogue that's going on. Evan Leader has the triangle of the relationships that are in the room. It's you as the shliach tzibor and God, you and the kahal and God, and you know, to make sure that all of those points are being activated simultaneously is very difficult. Yes, right. Creation, revelation, redemption. You know, a lot of triangles.
A willingness to learn, so that if they're, you know, like davening, and then they hear the shliach tzibor sing a new melody or sing something in a different way, not just turning off and tuning out, like a willingness to engage.
Sort of a little bit what Gela says, but specifically around engaging on new something you weren't expecting.
Yeah.
Now, I feel like there's a flip side conversation which we're not going to have, which is what are the responsibilities of the CBOR. And I think there's some limitation that people, there's some reasonable expectation of innovation that people have some tolerance for, and there's also some appetite for consistency or you know, I know what's going to be happening. That I remember I was once in one dominating scenario where somebody started speaking extensively about their mother in the middle of Kabbalah Shabbat. I was not expecting that. And it sort of pushed my boundaries a little too far. So you can, so as a leader, you have your own responsibilities. But as a member of the Kahal, to actually go with the leader, it's sort of like a spiritual practice to say, well, I don't know this nigun, but I'm going to try to sing along. Even though I don't know all the notes, I'm not going to wait for them to impress me with it. That's a particular stance. Yeah.
I always appreciate in a kahal a willingness not to go into autopilot, i.e. a willingness to listen. You know, if one starts, you know, like, even so, Haron, one goes immediately, Goma, na, 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 at their own tempo, at their own top of their lungs. I have these people in my show. They're wonderful, wonderful Jews. But I always appreciate when there's sort of a sensitivity to listening to where the Shaliach Tzibur is going.
Yeah, so I want to actually play on that a little bit because I think that this gets to the... You're pointing to something that I think is unusual in most synagogues, which is to say the moments when the kahal is taking charge, where they're running roughshod over the leader. Most of the time, I would say the kahal is fairly timid, mm-hmm. Or you know, in Heschel's language, he says religiously bashful. You know, this idea of I'm not going to be making a splash as a member of the kahal. So I actually think the relationship on some of those moments is a little. The way I think about it is basically there's a contract that's being set up, and the contract is that I, as the leader, am not going to be overpowered by the kahal. If I want to push the kahal somewhere, and I as a member of the kahal am not going to worry that I'm going to overpower the leader, because I think that otherwise you get into this very timid space where nobody is taking the lead except for the leader, where it's always the responsibility of the leader to start everything, because everybody's waiting for them to do it. A classic example of the opposite of this is this is a side story, but it's whatever, a little bit funny and sad, is that there was a minyan related to a wedding that my friend was at once, and the wedding was Sunday night, that a Monday morning shacharit minyan, and when it came time to open up the ark, they opened up the ark, and the Torah was missing. So most people are standing there just agape, and then some guy in the back says, Ashrei Adonai. Let's move on, people, right? Okay. So it turns out it was like a whole deal with the caterer who like had this scheme of stealing Torahs, whatever, but anyway, they recovered the Torah. But Jews, can you imagine it? But that's the side word. The point is that the kahal actually in that moment said, I'm moving on with davening, are you with me or not? So I think that there is a stance. And the people in this room, the great thing about being a Shliach Tzibur is that a lot of times you're not the Shliach Tzibur. Then you're just a regular member of the Kahal, which is my favorite role. And I think that it's a very active role if you view it in that way. Mm-hmm. And if you sort of say, I'm not here to be pushed around only. I'm also here to, like, take control of what's going on. And yet, listening is what you're saying. Listening if the leader's going to go in a different direction. Mm-hmm. I think about this a lot with any particular tehillah that is normally mumbled, but that the shatz wants to actually sing. And the greatest person, he's great at so many levels on davening stuff, but Eben Leader is amazing at this. Where you can, like, you can be mumbling, you know, like 100 people can be mumbling, and he can just skim over all of you and he'll start busting out with some nigun that you, if you're listening, but even if you're not listening because he has a very strong voice, but if you're listening, you'll notice, oh, I shouldn't be mumbling right now, I'm going to try to meld into this nigun. But there's a two-way street that's going on there, which I think is rarely active, but could be very powerful. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say, like, I would love, if I'm leading for the members of the kahal, to be loud in whatever they're doing, whether it's mumbling or saying amen or davening a part that I happen not to be at, so I'm aware as the Shaliach Tzibur that either I'm going too quickly or I'm doing a melody that people aren't familiar with or people want to sing Ve'ahavta out loud or whatever it is.
Like, yeah.
I want to hear those mumblings, and some of the best davening experiences that I've had have been moments when other people, I've heard like other people doing those things, so I've decided to go along with them.
You're a little bit led in that direction. That's interesting. Yeah, I think that there's this gets to the idea of what is my responsibility as a how could you hear me? How loud could I be if I'm, as Joey said, you know, miles away from you? It is your in that suburban synagogue situation, or even in the West End synagogue, which is not that big. You, the people in this room, have to be the ones to go sit near the leader. No one else is going to do it. Mm-hmm. It's got to be you, and it makes a huge difference. First of all, when I used to go to BJ, this is years ago. I used to sit way in the back because, first of all, I'd get there late. Second of all, there weren't any seats. But then I realized that there were seats plop in the front. And same thing with the Carl Bach Show. It's a totally different experience if you're in the front than if you're in the back. And nobody was preventing me from going to the front. Those seats are always available. So I think it's on us, people who double as leaders and followers in prayer scenarios, to just walk in and sit down next to the leader or towards the front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is more of a musical thing. So if the kahal really knows the melody and sings along, it frees up the shliach tzibur to do harmony and therefore to teach harmony. Mm-hmm. And this is something I consider it. I talked to the chazan at the local shul about this. He considers it my obligation to sing the melody really loud, so that he can harmonize.
Right. That's interesting. Okay, so it gets to the question of, you know, how much leading are you meant to be doing on the melody, and how many people know the melody, and, you know, what group you're davening with. But I think that's a great way of thinking about it. Yeah.
So I lead a lot in a chavura where I'm one of the stronger leaders, and I also daven, and I'm not leading a lot. And so what is my role when I walk into davening? Maybe I walk in a little bit late, and there's somebody sitting there leading davening whose voice is not as strong as mine, and I'm frankly not always sure what key they're on, and I sort of see it as
they're the leader.
What?
They're the leader.
They're the leader.
Right.
They're the leader. It's a small chavurah, and God bless them. They're leading. I have a baby. I can't lead all the time, and there are two or three other people who are in the same role as position as I am.
Right.
So this person's leading, and I see it as sort of my responsibility to support them as leader. So I give them a moment till I think I know what key they're trying to sing in and what tune they're using, and then I know it. And I will sing quietly until I can come up under them and not sing too loud so that they can lead.
Right.
Right. No, and so I can blend with them. And as a leader, I would like to have that same sort of support. You know, hang back for just a moment till you understand what it is I'm doing.
Right.
And then join me and support me.
Right.
And then that becomes that, like, when there's somebody strong enough and to support it so I can sing harmony, that's a
right.
miracle.
Yeah, no, I think it gets that relationship again, and I think that I will tell you this, as a leader, no, unless the people in this room change the dynamics on this, no one sings louder than you. If you're the leader, almost under no circumstances are people going to sing louder than you. And therefore you get this sort of like timid scare game where, you know, if the leader is davening softly because of whatever number of reasons that causes someone to be nervous about their volume, then you rarely have the kahal that's going to try to push the volume higher. But and you don't want to run roughshod over them, right? But on the other hand, you know, that's where the contract sort of breaks down. If the leader isn't able to carry the volume at a place where the kahal could actually go, then the leader needs to do a little bit of work. Joey.
Yeah, only one other thing is, if you did want people to pipe up, one way to do that is just by almost stopping to sing yourself. You pretend to sing.
Yeah. And you find that makes people louder or softer?
If it's in the right situation, and people are basically close by, and everybody's playing that game of not wanting, because they're actually being sensitive and paying attention, they don't want to be quiet louder than you.
Right.
If you want them to sort of take over, just stop.
But don't look like you're stopping. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, look like
you're like,
they don't know that you stopped. I mean, I know that you do it. I know it. I'm like, wait, I can't hear Joy anymore.
What I was actually going to say is that one of the worst feelings for me as a shliach tzibur is that sometimes when, you know, if it happens that if I take a breath or I trip on a word or something and I stop, and then everybody else stops too. I'm like, no, 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 you were supposed to keep going.
Right.
Like, all of a sudden there's this silence. I'm like, was I just pulling this tugboat the whole time?
Right, exactly. No, it's a terrible feeling when you realize that you're the only thing that's... That's why you, as the followers,
need
to keep on going.
Yeah.
For me.
I was waiting for a moment since the morning to mention this. A bunch of us were at the Shacharit this morning, and there was no agreement among us that we were going to all get by the Shaliach Tzibor and create that central space that we, you know, a crew that we had, that Joey had tried to propagandize. On us. But I got there and I was like, I wanted to do it. And I saw some people on the outskirts and I sort of tried to pull them in, but people like to be, I guess my point is, like, if we as a group have a hard time getting pulled into the middle, like, how much harder is it going to be to get the people in our communities to do it?
Yeah. There's a lot of factors. I mean, part of it is that, like, we all just met each other and there's some intimacy that's being, you know, played upon. But also, I did see Joey do this in a way I'd never seen anyone do it before. We were at a suburban synagogue in New Jersey and for a Shabbaton, and Joey gave the sermon at Musaf. And it was basically the demonstration without everybody getting into the corner, because they're already there about spreading out and all the different metaphors about why you need to get closer. And then it was like, bam, 25 people moved into the middle, and everybody got up and moved. Until one guy actually yelled out, he's like, "Are you going to ask us to move already or what?" And I think that there's the Shas doesn't do that usually,
right,
tell you, I invite you to come to the middle, but you could actually just invite people to come to the middle.
And again.
One thing of challenge, though, is that you do have people that really want to daven in their own space. And I've recently, when I've been davening with this minion that Nomi started, we have a setup where, like, we're kind of sitting in a circle, very tight, very intimate. Everyone feels very comfortable and warm with each other. But there have been times where one or two people got up from that already being close to everyone and removed themselves because they're just more comfortable davening with their own physical space. And then how do you kind of, like, still find a way to, you know, if I want to be davening over there because I just focus better away, but I still want to be kind of part of that sound and feel close to Shaliach, how do you bring people in when they really are far away without saying you need to be physically closer?
Yeah.
Like, how do we...
No, I think you're pointing to something critical, which is that there's a lot of aesthetic issues that everybody experiences differently. And, for me, a moment of intimacy and noise fusion is for you a moment of claustrophobia and get me out of here. To be sensitive to that and just to recognize, because luckily it seems like you're dominating an apartment, so you can't get that far away, even if you're in the corner, from the sound perspective. I'll just mention two other things, and we're going to dive into some of these texts. These are fairly simple. Joey mentioned one of them is the seating position. I'm violating it right now. I do not think you can daven with your legs crossed. Period. You can't do it. I feel like you have to be, like, ready. Who knows? You're going to be like, I might be ready to, like, leap up at any moment, because who knows what might happen, you know?
Like,
and you can't, you just can't. It just doesn't work. So, and it sends this message of, like, yeah, I'm ready to have a little afternoon conversation with, you know, maybe whatever, book discussion. It's, you know, it's, you're not set up for an engaged experience, I think, when you're crossing your legs. And the other thing, which is fairly obvious but very hard to control, is just don't talk. Okay, enough said about that. So, we're going to focus on one specific aspect of the aesthetic of davening, which is volume, and we're going to try to work on some of it as well. But I wanted to look at some texts around that issue, because it's a very old issue in davening, and has some variety. So, does someone want to read? There's a great book called Prayer Book Reform in Europe, which is the trace of the history of the beginning of Reform Judaism in Germany, and the prayer books that they produced. And in addition to prayer books, they also produced ordinances, and these are a few of the ordinances around davening. So can someone just read them?
Are there
out loud?
Any more? We ended up
with, you ended up with the
one.
Oh, did anyone else? These, they're double-sided, so there you go. Shoshi, take it away.
The members of the congregations are reminded and ordered to follow the cantor's prayers quietly and silently. They must refrain from the illegal and cacophonous shouting, which so frequently disturbs peaceful and true devotion.
Okay. Why don't you read the other two, which are related.
The congregation must listen silently to the prayers recited by the cantor. By no means must they audibly pray together with him, let alone sing with him. During the repetition of the prayers by the cantor, as well as during the reading of the Torah portion, everybody must refrain from accompanying the recitation of the reading with his own singing or reading.
Right. But that one actually kind of snuck through. Today we sort of end the Torah reading in liberal congregations. They end the Torah reading with everybody like piping up for the last word. But you can see that the idea of, you know, the timidity comes out of some cultural, decorum desire, you know, which in proper Germany is not to be having cacophonous shouting, but to actually, listen quietly.
And it's also in some ways part of the halachic literature, that especially during the Kedusha, you know, you listen for the parts that are not yours.
Yeah, so we're going to get to some of the halachic literature on this, because it doesn't come out of nowhere. There is some sense of, there is a moment to be quiet and to listen to the cantor. But nevertheless, I mean, whenever I look at these texts in a group of people like this, there's always a little bit of laughter because it sounds so absurd. It's like, first of all, I mean, it's absurd because who makes rules like these? Like, but second of all, it's like, you don't need a rule like this anymore. Like, this is the state of affairs. You know what I'm saying?
They want.
They want. Well, right. Yeah. It depends where you're adopting.
Westphalia sounds pretty raucous.
Westphalia sounds pretty raucous, meaning they're making a rule to counter what's actually going on. I'm sorry.
Okay.
You're saying there isn't
illegal and cacophonous shouting sounds.
Who shouts
usual? Yeah.
Correct. Right. I mean, I'm saying.
Yeah. No, I mean, but that they had to respond, or they felt they had to.
Right, but if you go to like, you know, a Hasidic shtiebel where it's just, I mean, like up until, you know, some like Shema oriented part of the davening. Everybody is basically doing their own thing, going nuts. Now, they might not term it illegal, obviously, but...
Yeah, okay. You're counting that as cacophonous shouting.
Yes, the German reform would have seen it that way.
You're exaggerating. You're using hyperbole, maybe.
You know what, Miriam, why don't you read the next text, which is the opposite?
Number two?
Yes.
Story told. Oh, it's very nasty. Story told by a Carlina Hasid.
The Carlinas are known for screaming in their davening. That is illegal and cacophonous shouting.
Amisnagi went to the Carlina Rebbe and asked him, "Why do you scream when you pray?" The Rebbe took a pen and jabbed him in the side. Amisnagi let out a scream. When you're in pain, you scream.
It's a little Hasidic ditty in the style of a Hasidic story, but I think there's something deep about that. When everything is perfect and prim and proper, there's an emotional you're sort of tamping down on the emotions. When you're screaming, you know, something's going on. Or, you know, there's a lot of value placed on crying in prayer. In traditional sources, you see this sometimes in contemporary places of davening. You know, I was once at the Kotel, saw somebody daven, sort of forcing himself to cry while daven. It's a different experience. It's a different emotional experience when you're getting to that side of the, you know, of the register than it is, you know, in Westphalia. It's the two extremes, let's say, of what we have at our disposal. Most places are somewhere in the middle of the screaming and the total silence. But I think that I wanted to spend a few minutes just looking at the way in which volume, I mean, Matt alluded to this, but in the halachic literature, just the way in which volume plays a different role for different prayers, and then we're going to do a little bit of a workshop ourselves on some volume stuff. That sound like a plan? Okay, so what I'm going to ask you to do is just, you're going to turn to your neighbor, and you're going to read, basically, sources 3 through... if you can get to 8, great. If not, 3 through 6. Okay? And we'll come back in like 10, 12 minutes. Okay?
We're going straight.
And the question is, what is the difference between... My question for you is, what's the difference between the Shema and the Amidah?
in terms of volume.
One of them you can stand.
Okay. Okay. You can stand if you need to.
Okay. 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 Yeah.